There's a whole bunch of things going on this verse. I just want to briefly take us through the verses because it actually is very important to what's going on and how the Mishnah is different from the verses themselves. So here it is. It's in the second parasha. I think, is it in Bamidbar or Naso? I think it's in Bamidbar. So this tisteh, this root over here, has gone astray. That's the same root as the sota, whether it's with a sin or with a samach, it's all the same. It's not a very common word. This is where it appears here. So the question is, any man's wife has gone astray, and she has then gone and had sex with another man, and this matter was hidden from her husband. And this term is going to come up. She became defiled, sort of impure, which is sort of metaphorical. It's not literally she's impure. It's a metaphorical impurity of morality, moral impurity, rather than literal ritual impurity. And there's the aid einba. There's no witnesses. Hilom nitpasa, and she wasn't forced. So there are no witnesses. That's one of the key things of the case, is the fact that there's no way to know whether she did this exactly or not. Now the way he talks about it, but avara lav ruach kina, sort of fit of jealousy, a spirit of jealousy takes him over, like comes upon him. It seems to be a very negative way to refer to him. This is not based in reality anymore. Now it's based in a ruach kina, in a jealous rage, not based in reality at all. But kineya tishtov he nitma, and he is jealous about this situation. Or whether she did it or not, he is very jealous about it. So then the husband can bring his wife to the Kohen and can bring a sacrifice as well, which is this particular sacrifice, the tenth of an Ephah. And then the Kohen will bring the sacrifice and will stand the woman before Lifnei Adonai, which means to stand up in the temple before the priests. The priest takes holy water in a clay pot, and from the earth, put some of that into the water. Rosh Haisha uncovers her head, which is definitely a state of dishonor. Men and women should have heads covered, according to the Mishnah in general. So she, and then the waters, hamarim hamararim, the bitter waters. Great. So there's earth and water. The idea of putting God's name in the thing is coming up. Now the priest gets has a declaration, which the priest says to the wife, if you didn't do this, then this is totally fine. You'll have no harm whatsoever. But if you did do it, then it continues on. May the Lord make you a curse and an imprecation among your people. As the Lord causes your thigh to sag and your belly to distend, may this water that induces the spell into your body, causing the belly to distend and the thigh to sag. And the woman shall say, Amen, Amen. So this is the key moment of the ritual. And then the priest would write the curses and rub off the ink into the water. So it seems like he writes the curses here, and then makes her drink the water, then takes her sacrifice, deals with the sacrifice, and that's it, basically. That's the ritual. So the key moments are the crumbling something into the water, taking some earth into the water, some kind of magic potion, and making her drink it, and giving her this oath, making sure that she, giving her this oath to say, or rather, the priest says, if you did it. It's like the movie we see at Jury Duty. Oh yeah, I haven't seen that movie, but yes, it could be. Okay, what I wanted to say about this is that it seems to me that the Pshat of the Torah, and I don't think everyone agrees with me, but it seems to me pretty clear that the way the Torah understands this is, the only way the husband would know whether she has had sex with another man is if she's pregnant. That's the fundamental way that she would know this, because the whole point is there are no witnesses. There's no way to tell one way or the other. So presumably she's pregnant and he thinks the child isn't his. That makes this curse make a lot more sense. I think what this curse is trying to say, right, to say that she'll have a miscarriage. The point of the potion is that it causes a miscarriage if the child is not the husband's. And will not cause a miscarriage if the child is the husband's. That seems to me the Pshat of the Torah about the case we're dealing with here. That is not the way the Mishnah understands it. It's not how the way most people understand it. And there's a whole bunch of additional items that are added to this ritual. As you will see, it becomes much more sort of court-based, much less priest-based. They do some interesting things about the ritual and how it works, which will play out in the Mishnah. But I just wanted to make sure we saw those verses because it's a very strange ceremony, lots of odd things going on, and it's important to see where the Mishnah differs from the Torah. Okay, and we're going to see the first difference basically straight away, beginning Mishnah 1. Let me give the link, If she's innocent, you have to pay for the cost of sacrifice. Yes, that's true, though the sacrifice is not very much, but yes. So the question is whether the Torah's ritual is basically assuming that she's innocent or not. And it definitely, if she is innocent, it makes the husband look like a total moron. So that's good. I don't think that the husband would be encouraged to go into this process. This process is probably just a way to resolve something that's unresolvable, right? The husband has this like ruach kin'ah, this spirit of jealousy that he can't shake. And the best way to get rid of it is to like prove to him one way or the other. So as long as he believes in the efficacy of the ritual, this will work. This will either prove to him what he needs to know, which is that his wife cheated on him, or it will prove to him that she didn't, and then everything is fine. They can continue with their marriage. So it's a kind of a way of saving marriages in that way. But I'm not sure a husband would be incentivized to go through this, to make his wife go through this procedure per se. You'd have to be a bit like really angry with her in order to do this, because you might end up looking like a total moron. Okay, now, the first thing we do is we put directly into the legal framework. Hamkaneh le'ishto, one who warns his wife, who is jealous. This is the same root as the ruach kinah, the jealousy. It immediately means something different in the Mishnah. It becomes a legal procedure. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, mekaneila al pi shnayim, umashka al pi eid echad or al pi atzmo. Rabbi Eliezer says the way this works is he has to declare his jealousy in front of two witnesses. Then she is fed the water. She is given the water under the by one witnesses or just him. So that's how he upholds the requirement. The thing the Torah says when there are no witnesses, he upholds it by saying, "Yeah, you don't need the minimum number of witnesses to make her drink the waters, but you do need a formal process where you like." The husband and the wife, the husband gets the wife, stands her up there, brings two witnesses in and says, hey, as you'll see in a second, don't go to talk to this man. You can't talk to this man, please don't. And then she does it anyway. That's the formal process of the kane. And then according to Rabbi Eliezer, either somebody can like see her her like going out of the house of this guy or something, like some witness the act in some way, or he can just do it himself. Just by his ruach kina, just by his jealousy. Rabbi Yoshua Omer, mekaneila al pishnayim umashka al pishnayim. Rabbi Yoshua takes it even further out of the non-legal framework and puts it back into the legal framework. He says that actually, just as the formal process of warning has to be done before two witnesses, you can only make her drink on the testimony of two witnesses. It's now become totally a court case. So that's already the first transformation. You can see straight away it's left the realm of, like the way the Mishnah wants to set the tone is it's left the realm of sort of magic ritual and entered into the world of law and the legal process. And now we're going to discuss what the warning looks like. What is this process of mekaneh, of showing his jealousy? Ketzad mekaneh la, how does he warn her? Amar la b'fnei shnayim, he says to her before two witnesses, Al tadabri im ish ploni, so-and-so, don't talk with him, v'dibra imo, and then she went and did it anyway. Adayin hi muteret leveita umuteret leechol batruma. In that situation, she is still allowed to enter his house and eat truma if she's a kohen. So let me explain this. What's going on here is, that as soon as, the way the Mishnah also understands this, as soon as a sota declaration has been made, as soon as he has decided to take her to the priests in order to make her undergo the sota ritual, as soon as that happens, they're now not totally married, they're forbidden to each other, and they can't have sex with each other, and that's happens instantly. So what we're saying here is, this is just speaking with the person is not enough to make the marriage immediately pause. What you need is nichnasa imo levet haseter, v'shahata imo kadei tuma, asura leveta v'asura lechol batruma. If she went into a hidden room with a private place, in other words, with the man that she was warned about, and then stayed there long enough, kadei tuma, in order to have sex, asura leveta v'asura lechol batruma, then she's forbidden to come back and to eat truma. So the point is also about, by the way, eat truma, which is that the wife of a kohen can always eat truma. In a lot of nashim, the eating truma is sort of a proxy for how strong is the bond of marriage. Like, is the bond is the marriage still in effect? If so, then if your husband is a priest, you can eat truma, and if not, then you can't. So that's exactly what this is trying to get here. Not only is she forbidden to her husband, but consequently, she's also forbidden to eat truma if he's a kohen. And if she were a kohen, she could go back to her father's house and eat truma there, but not otherwise. Ve'immeit choletzet v'lo mityabemet. If he dies, if the husband dies after this process, after he has warned her, and then she has gone into seclusion with this guy, the guy that he warned her about. Also note, it has to be a specific guy. It can't just be like, don't talk to people. Like, it has to be a very specific, like, I'm worried about you and this particular person. So yeah, if the husband dies after this process, and while they're forbidden to each other, and he has a brother. So this is a case of now they don't have any children and he has a living brother. Normally the case would be if a husband died without any children and has a brother, that the brother should have to either marry the widow, or they do the ceremony chalitza, which severs the bonds, spitting in someone's face and with a shoe. So yeah, so this is another way of saying that, like, the bond has to end. What you have to do is you have to do chalitza. You can't do yibam. You can't do the levirate marriage. She would never marry the brother of that guy. She would only do chalitza. She would just break the bond with that family and walk away. Again, this is a way of saying, like, this bond is broken. Like, you can't pretend that everything is, that this marriage is fine. It's definitely not fine. And therefore, there's no way to, why would she agree to, like, there's no way in which it makes sense that she should still be tied to this family that, like, tarnished her reputation in this way, or that she cheated on and in that way dishonored the family. Why should she be tied to that family? There's no way to do that. So if he dies after this process, when they're sort of forbidden to each other, that's the end. There's no relationship with the family anymore. The elu asurot milechol batruma. Here are the situations where she would be forbidden to eat truma. This is another way of, again, using this as a proxy of the marriage is in trouble. Yes, an unmarried daughter. Yes, exactly right. Interesting that unfounded judgment is treated as just as destructive to the relationship as actual infidelity. Yes, not even interesting. I think it's, like, really true. Like, at the point where you have got your spouse, got two witnesses, and like, made a declaration before them saying, do not talk to so-and-so. Like, at that point, like, this marriage is already in trouble. Like, you could have headed this off at the pass a long time ago. Are there any texts that address child custody? Yeah, it's a good question. I actually, so I think the default case of child custody would be that they would live with the father and live off the father's estate. There probably are texts that address that. And if so, they'll be in Ketubot. Either the Mishnah Tosefta or the Bavli. I might look into that because that's a great question. Okay, ve'elu asrot milachol batruma. Here are the cases where she would be forbidden to eat truma. Ha'omeret tmeya ani lecha. If she says to him, you know what? Yeah, I'm impure to you. I actually did cheat on you. So anyways, if she admits to cheating on him, then immediately she doesn't eat the truma anymore. Two witnesses came to say that she had sex with this guy. In that case, also she would immediately, the marriage is immediately suspended. Or if she went through this process, the husband warned her formally, She denies it and nonetheless still says, but I will not drink. I refuse to drink the waters. That case also, there's no way out of that. So the marriage is suspended straight away. Or if her husband doesn't want to make her drink, but nonetheless, there's still this, he did the first stage where he warned her in front of two witnesses, but he doesn't actually want to make her go to the temple and drink the waters. In that case, it doesn't matter. You've already started the processes. You could have made her do that. Like the marriage is basically severed or suspended. Or Shebala ba'aleha vaderech. Or that after all of these things happened, that the warning thing happened already, they decided to drink the water. I don't think anyone wants to drink the water. Yeah, they put dirt in the water. Yeah, you do not want to drink that. But they also they also put the name of God in the water according to the Mishnah, and also some ink. So it would not have been a very nice potion, but it's not supposed to be a nice potion. So if you went through the process of warning, and you went through the process of you decided that we're going to go and take you to Jerusalem to drink the water, but then they had sex on the way, that also ends the marriage, or at least suspends the marriage, because their whole point is they're supposed to be apart. So like this just undercuts the whole point here. They're not left suspended necessarily. I think basically the marriage has to end in divorce. is basically how it works. By the way, the Mishnah does not think at all, does not have a problem in any way with a court instituting a divorce, like forcing a couple to be divorced. The Mishnah doesn't care about that. That does that in several places. So she might not be able to remarry to a Kohen, though I think that's going to come up at some point. But yeah, she might not be able to be married to a Kohen because a Kohen can't marry a divorcee. Yes, that's correct. So Ketzad Osela, what should he do instead? What should he do with her instead to avoid this some of these problems, like having sex along the way to the court? Molichala Beit Din Sheba'oto Makom. He should take her to the court in wherever place they live. Umostrin lo shnei talmidei chachamim, shema yavo aleha baderech. They actually hand over. The court sort of hands over to him two court officials, Talmidei Chachamim here, students, disciples, presumably judges, disciples in the court, in order that they can sort of guard her from this Yavo Aleha Baderech. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ba'ala Ne'eman Aleha. Rabbi Yehuda is not concerned about this problem. He just assumes that the husband is in fact trustworthy, and will not have sex with a woman that he just accused of cheating on him, and therefore he's not worried about having the two independent parties to make sure that this doesn't happen. Yeah, so basically, like, these are thorny issues. The livelihood of a woman is at stake, as you pointed out. So yeah, so you got to be careful just to make sure that they don't become unnecessarily forbidden to each other, and that there is some kind of resolution to this tension and this ruach kinah, to this jealousy. Okay, so we'll continue along next time. We're going to go to Jerusalem. Thank you, everyone. See you tomorrow.